morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February the 2nd. Here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. The African Union and the West African bloc ECOWAS condemned an attempted coup in Guinea-Bissau after heavy gunfire was heard near a government compound where the president had been chairing a cabinet meeting on Tuesday. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres is appealing to all parties in Ethiopia to immediately end the fighting in Tigray and other areas in the spirit of the General Assembly's Olympic truce.
I make the strongest possible appeal for all parties in Ethiopia for an immediate cessation of hostilities.
Nigerian authorities have sent security reinforcements to areas in three states where armed groups killed scores of people over the weekend.
Our security forces, our security intelligence community should get their act together.
And the World Health Organization is warning of healthcare risks posed by discarded COVID-19 equipment. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Guinea-Bissau's President Umaru Sissoko Embalo survived an attempted coup on Tuesday, but said many members of his security forces had been killed as they fought the attackers. Appearing in the evening in a video posted on the Guinea-Bissau presidency's Facebook page, President Embalo said the attackers had tried to enter the compound just after the cabinet meeting, but had been repelled. The African Union and the West African bloc ECOWAS condemned the attempted coup. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a return to constitutional order in Guinea-Bissau.
It is for us clear that coups are totally unacceptable. We are seeing a terrible multiplication of coups. And our strong appeal is for soldiers to go back to the barracks and for the constitutional order to be fully in place in the democratic context of today's Guinea-Bissau.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Tensions between Mali and former colonial power France have hit a new low, with the military government giving the French ambassador until Thursday to leave the country. Annie Risenbach speaks to analysts about where relations are headed in this report from Mali's capital, Bamako.
The French ambassador to Mali, Joël Maier, has been given 72 hours from Monday to leave the West African country. Maier was summoned to the Malian Ministry of Foreign Affairs in response to remarks made by French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian. On Friday, Le Drian said Mali's military junta, which seized power last May, was out of control and illegitimate. Speaking on state television ORTM on Monday evening, Mali's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Abdoulaye Diop, acknowledged that the ambassador has been ordered to depart. Diop said the ambassador is welcome to return if France changes its position on Mali, but stated that France calling into question the legitimacy of the Malian government is a line that neither ECOWAS nor the UN has crossed. He says, this declaration is to call into question the legality and the legitimacy of the authorities with whom precisely the French ambassador is accredited. This creates a very difficult situation because you cannot be accredited by an authority that you do not recognize yourself. Anna Schmouder is a Sahel researcher at the Klingendel Institute, a think tank in the Netherlands focused on international affairs. She spoke via a messaging application from The Hague.
Well, I would say after this escalation and the expulsion of the French ambassador, retreat of the entirety of the French Barkhane mission from Mali is definitely on the table.
Operation Barkhane is a French-led anti-insurgent operation in the Sahel launched in 2014. Schmouder says any changes to the Barkhane mission in Mali will also likely affect the French-led European Takuba Task Force, and possibly even the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali, MINUSMA. But she adds that it's too early to say what exactly could be the political fallout, because such a significant decline in Mali-France relations is without precedent. Kalilu Sidibe is a professor of political science at the University of Legal and Political Sciences of Bamako and a political analyst. He said the expulsion of the ambassador could push France to relocate the Barkhane base, which is currently in Gao, Mali, to another country in the Sahel. He says despite the diplomatic setback, France plays an important role in the fight against Islamist groups. V. via a messaging application from Bamako, Sidibe also said that aside from the military implications, humanitarian projects could now be at risk.
La France a investi et intervient dans plusieurs
France invests and intervenes in several development and humanitarian programs in Mali, he says. If they suspend the financing of these, this will have a negative impact in terms of livelihood for the community, in terms of access to basic resources, social services, sanitation, hygiene, education, and health. Both Schmauder and Sidibe underscore that the expulsion of the ambassador does not signify a total rupture in diplomatic relations. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
In response to last week's military coup, the African Union has suspended Burkina Faso's membership until constitutional order is restored. ECOWAS, the West African regional bloc, has already suspended Burkina Faso but stopped short of imposing sanctions. According to a Reuters report, an ECOWAS delegation, along with a United Nations envoy, are due to visit Burkina Faso to meet with the coup leaders before deciding on the next steps. On January 25th, rebel soldiers detained President Roch Kabore amid rising public anger at his failure to stem jihadist violence in the nation. Meanwhile, according to the French news agency AFP, the long-awaited trial in Burkina Faso over the 1987 assassination of revolutionary leader Thomas Sankara is being suspended until the restoration of the constitution. The trial of Sankara's alleged killers was to resume at a military court in the capital, Ouagadougou. Nigerian authorities have sent security reinforcements to areas in three states where armed groups killed scores of people over the weekend. Nigerian police say the gangs targeted civilians and security personnel in Nigeria's northwest and central states of Niger, Katsina, and Kaduna. Security analysts say the attacks underscore authorities' failure to stem violence in the regions, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Authorities said the gangs, referred to locally as bandits, killed 12 people in Katsina, 11 in Niger, and 11 in Kaduna state. Some of the victims were burned alive as the attackers rained terror on communities, razing down houses. Niger state authorities say fatalities included security personnel who were killed when gunmen overran a security base in the Shiroro local government area. Commissioner of Police Monday Balakoya says authorities are responding to the attacks.
We have built up security in that place. And what we are doing also, areas that are closer, where we suspect bandits are there, we have also mobilized officers to those places. And we are monitoring.
Authorities have also deployed heavily armed security reinforcements to the affected areas in Kaduna and Katsina states. Authorities have not announced any arrests in connection with the attacks. On Tuesday, Katsina State Police spokesperson Gambo Issa said an undetermined number of people were also kidnapped in a separate attack in the state. Security analyst Kabiru Adamu says security threats will persist unless government's forces dislodge forest hideouts known where the gangs usually take cover.
They need to dominate it. And by dominating it, I mean to take over those forests so that these bandits don't have space to operate in any longer. Any effort that is done and those forests are left unoccupied, it would mean these bandits will come to them, especially in this instance where these gunmen are able to move across borders.
But the lingering security problems have been stretching Nigeria's internal security architecture. Last year, Nigeria designated the troops as terrorist organizations. Experts say, in theory, the designation gives security forces more fighting power and makes punishment against offenders more defined. But security analyst Ebenezer Oyetakin says corruption is preventing authorities from making much progress.
Our security forces, our security intelligence community should get their act together. We have compromised elements both in our security system and in the financial system and in the society.
Last month, some 200 people were killed and about 10,000 displaced after armed gangs launched a reprisal in northwestern Nigerian state of Zamfara following military air raids on their hideouts. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Ethiopian Airlines says that it will resume flying Boeing 737's MAX planes Tuesday, nearly 3 years after a deadly crash killed 157 people.
Ethiopian Airlines, one of the large carriers in Africa, has said it will resume flying Boeing 737 MAX planes beginning Tuesday. In a statement to the French news agency AFP, the airline said the decision came after a thorough certification process by regulators across the globe, including the United States, Europe, and Asia, as well as Ethiopia. All 737 MAX planes were grounded worldwide in March 2019 after the aircraft crashed near the Ethiopian town of Bishoftu, killing all 157 people on board. The previous October, the crash of a 737 MAX in Indonesia killed 189. Boeing has since made design changes to the aircraft, and the planes have returned to service in most countries. Indonesia recertified the plane in December. Ethiopian Airlines CEO Tewolde Gebremariam said the company will be among the last airlines to resume flying the MAX model. Tewolde said the airline has taken more than 20 months to monitor and recertify the plane. The airline said its pilots and technicians have been fully trained regarding the plane's modifications. Kelmo Dwight for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for a cessation of hostilities by all parties in the conflict in Ethiopia in the spirit of the Olympics truce. Mr. Guterres made the remarks as he was preparing to leave for the Tokyo Olympic and Paralympic Games.
The people of Ethiopia continue to suffer greatly from ongoing conflict and bloodshed. For millennia, the tradition of the Olympic truce has called on all parties everywhere to stop hostilities throughout the course of the Games. As I prepare to leave for the Winter Olympics, I make the strongest possible appeal for all parties in Ethiopia for an immediate cessation of hostilities. And this can allow for effective humanitarian access and relief to all affected populations throughout Ethiopia. And these actions will help pave the way to a much-needed inclusive national dialogue involving all Ethiopians. I reiterate my appeal to all parties to follow the finest tradition of the Olympic spirit to save lives, overcome differences, and find the path to real peace.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The World Health Organization warns of healthcare risks posed by discarded COVID-19 equipment and is calling on nations to better manage their systems for disposing of the used gear. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Tackling the COVID-19 pandemic requires the use of huge quantities of personal protective equipment, or PPE, and the use of needles and syringes to administer vaccines, among other essential products. A new World Health Organization global analysis finds the quantities of healthcare waste generated by the goods are enormous and potentially dangerous. Maggie Montgomery is the technical officer for water, sanitation, and health in the WHO Department of Environment. She says COVID-19 has increased healthcare risks in facilities at up to 10 times previous volumes.
You know, if you consider that 2 in 3 healthcare facilities in the least developed countries didn't have systems to segregate or safely treat waste before the pandemic, you can just imagine how much burden this extra waste load has put on healthcare workers, on surrounding communities, especially where waste is burned.
The report finds the hazardous disposal of COVID-19 waste potentially exposes health workers to needle stick injuries, burns and pathogenic microorganisms, air pollution, and many dangers associated with living near poorly managed landfills and waste disposal sites. WHO experts analyzed approximately 87,000 tons of PPE that were shipped to needy countries between March 2020 and November 2021 through a joint UN emergency initiative. Most of the equipment, they say, was expected to end up as waste. The report provides an initial indication of the scale of the COVID-19 waste problem that exists only within the health sector, which is enormous. Montgomery says it does not look at the volumes of waste being generated in the wider community.
In terms of the waste generated by the public, in particular masks, for example, in 2020, there were 4.5 trillion additional disposable masks thrown away by the public, which led to 6 million tons of additional waste. So certainly the public is generating the most. At the same time, we feel that the health sector has a really important role, and there are many concrete things that can be done to reduce unnecessary use of PPE.
WHO recommendations for safer and more environmentally sustainable waste practices include using eco-friendly packaging and shipping, safe and reusable gloves and medical masks, and investing in non-burn waste treatment technologies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Voice of America! South Africa's luxury housing dealers said that the market is booming despite economic damage from the coronavirus pandemic. Real estate agents say the need to work from home and have better security are some of the drivers, while affordable housing for the poor remains a challenge. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's luxury real estate market saw an unexpected boom in 2021, despite the country's broader economic woes. Property analytics firm Lightstone reported that the luxury market experienced a six-year high in the total purchase value of transfers. Realtors say the pandemic has played a role in inspiring home buyers to go big. Charlene Negus is an agent with the Fertz Realty Company.
Because everybody is now working from home, everything has changed. People now need almost like a study for every individual in the home. So if you have two teenagers and two adults, you actually need four workspaces now because they all end up working from home. So a lot more study space.
She says backup electricity sources and updated internet infrastructure are among the amenities buyers are demanding. They're also considering the many ways they use their homes, from work to play.
People now need double the reception space because you want a facility where various parts of the family can have gatherings going on at the same time. Also, very importantly, is the inside-outside feel.
Still, the housing landscape is feeling the effects of the pandemic. South Africa has seen jobless rates top 35%. It's led to people selling their homes, downsizing, and even moving in with other family members. Michelle Dickens is the CEO of TPN Credit Bureau.
Overall, we actually saw deterioration in the number of sales in South Africa. In fact, we saw about a 15% deterioration in the number of sales from the preceding year. And we're down about 50% from the decade prior to that. So ultimately what we need is job recovery in order to encourage demand, both on the rental and on the for sale side of the property market.
Dickens says vacancy rates in city centers have been on the rise since the pandemic began. At the same time, the country has a massive housing shortage. The Center for Affordable Housing Finance in Africa reports a shortfall of 3.7 million homes, and that gap is expected to grow by 178,000 homes every year. It means 20% of urban households are in informal settlements. Government housing isn't being built fast enough, and older houses in communities like Soweto are rapidly falling apart. Benjamin Van Wyk is a pastor in the Cliptown neighborhood of Soweto.
As a pastor, I'm crying because this is not the only houses that looks like this. There are even others that is also worse. Even if we could have had money, we would have built our own places. But because people, they don't have jobs, even myself, I'm not working. My wife is not working, you see. So really, we are not fine. We are not okay.
The result is a landscape of extremes, with slums and informal settlements on one end and luxury homes on the other. Angelo Fick is the director of research for the AWOL Socioeconomic Research Institute.
The decreasing upper middle class will retreat into compounds behind fences, privatized estates, and sometimes even privatized cities. But that's only sustainable in the medium term. That's not long-term sustainability.
The long-term outlook on the housing market is unclear while the effects of the pandemic are played out. Experts say only economic growth and a drop in South Africa's unemployment rate will improve the landscape. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Now, golf is sometimes seen as a sport only accessible to an elite few. But in Senegal, one female golf star is redefining the sport's image and challenging her country's conservative gender norms. Anika Hammerschlag reports from Sali in Senegal.
When pro golfer Umi Jai first started competing against men, she felt intimidated. They didn't want to play with her, she says, and they didn't take her seriously. But then, in her first match, she won. After that, she had all the confidence she needed to keep playing and beating the boys. Now, as the only professional female golfer in Senegal, she competes almost exclusively against men. As she makes her way through the baobab-lined golf course in Sali, she greets the other golfers. They're all men.
Maintenant, je suis habituée de jouer avec les hommes. Je m'entraîne matin, midi, soir.
She says she's now used to playing with men. She trains in the morning, noon, and night. She says she goes to the gym 3 or 4 times per week, and that also gives her more confidence. Jai turned professional 7 years ago. She's placed in dozens of competitions around the world, including in Thailand, Kenya, and South Africa. The shelves in her living room are overflowing with trophies and medals. Her accomplishments are particularly noteworthy, considering Senegal is a conservative Muslim nation where women are discouraged from participating in sports, especially at the professional level.
Quand on est musulman, on préfère toujours garder les filles à la maison.
She says when you're Muslim, girls are kept at home so they can find a husband and be made into a housewife. In 2020, the Senegalese Golf Federation agreed to help Jai establish a golf academy in preparation for the 2026 Summer Youth Olympics in Dakar. It would be the first Olympic Games to ever be held on African soil. The project was postponed due to COVID, but it is expected to restart this year. Jai will be tasked with training Senegal's first ever national team, with a special focus on preparing the next generation of female golfers, including her daughter. Beatty Ayn is the president of Senegal's Golf Federation.
Girls will be part of it, on an equal basis like boys. And that would be something that I think we are prepared and committed to do. And Umi also has that vision and committed to promote the girl, to give them opportunity as a girl to, help them get to the level that they can be.
Jai says she hopes to find a sponsor so she can continue to compete internationally and bring the next generation of Senegalese female golfers into the fold. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Sali, Senegal.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clott, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.